Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national and international speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it and then happen to hit the play button on your iPad, iPod, computer, wherever, whatever device you're using. Today we have a real interesting show as we look back across the Atlantic Ocean for an update on some of the interesting approaches towards e-discovery being developed in the UK. We've done some interesting shows with Chris Dale in the past, and for today's show, we also have the Honorable Stephen Whitaker joining him. For those of you who are not familiar with Master Whitaker, he is the equivalent of Judge Grimm, Shindlin, and Facciola just in the UK. And both of these panelists made a presentation, which was a very well-attended presentation at Legal Tech in New York, which I saw in February, where I asked both of them to do this podcast. Senior Master Stephen Whitaker is the Senior Master of the Senior Courts of England and Wales in the Queen's Bench Division, the Queen's Remembrancer, and a former barrister. In U.S. terms, he would be considered a senior magistrate judge, fulfilling a similar role as Judge Grimm or Judge Facciola in the United States court system. Amongst his other duties, he manages a special list for mesothelioma and other asbestos-related claims at the Royal Courts of Justice in London. He was one of the judicial members of the Civil Procedure Rules Committee of England and Wales from 2002 through 2008. Was also a member of one of the judicial advisory groups advising the Secretary of State in the use of IT in the civil and family courts. Master Whitaker is named as the central authority for England and Wales under the Hague Conventions on Service and the Taking of Evidence. He has long been an enthusiastic proponent of the use of technology in UK courts, and as a frequent speaker at conferences and seminars on e-disclosure, civil procedure reforms, and on the management of asbestos-related claims. He's also the honorary president of LIST, the Legal Technology Support Group. Chris Dale qualified as an English solicitor in 1980 after reading history at Oxford. He was a litigation partner in London and then a litigation software developer and litigation support consultant before turning to commentary on electronic disclosure discovery. He runs the eDisclosure Information Project, which disseminates information about the court rules, the problems, and the technology to lawyers and their clients, to judges, and their suppliers. He's a member of Senior Master Whitaker's Working Party, which drafted the new practice direction and electronic documents questionnaire. He writes the UK's only authoritative and objective website and blog on the subject, and is a well-known speaker and commentator in the UK, the US, and other common law jurisdictions. So thank you both of you for joining us across the using the internet, connecting over here to this podcast site. And before I start, I always like to ask both of you, tell me a little bit about how you got interested in electronic discovery, and I'll start first with you, Master Whitaker.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a great deal of difference between Chris and I, except I read history at Cambridge, and he read history at the wrong university.
Thank you.
And that was a pretty good introduction to our future lives, I suspect. The problems with e-disclosure in litigation in this country, I think, really only started to surface 2002, 2003, about the same time that I joined the judiciary. And I became interested in it, basically because at that particular time, most of the problems were to do with structured databases and how you search them, and how you got the evidence out of them. Very often it was in fraud cases. Since then, it's expanded enormously. I deal with a very large number of heavyweight civil cases, particularly ones with multiple parties, in which the disclosure burden is very, very extensive indeed. And gradually over the years, since 2002, 2003, the amount of electronic documentation has become enormous. So I've very much got a personal vested interest in dealing with electronic disclosure as efficiently as possible, if only because I very often have to make the decisions in it. So that's really my background.
And Chris, how about yourself?
You've already recited that I was a solicitor and then went into litigation software development. Those are a pretty good background for what I then started doing, which is writing and speaking about the subject, because my experience on the selling side showed that there was not just ignorance, but an understandable ignorance in many ways, but misunderstandings as to what it was all about. And it seemed that that was a there was a niche there to spread information. It started in the UK and very quickly spread to the US and to other jurisdictions, principally the common law jurisdictions, which require discovery for litigation and for other purposes.
Yeah, we have similar paths. So we have Master Whitaker is the equivalent of Judge Grimm and Fatiola, and we are very similar too. So this will be interesting. So anyway, Chris, what are the most significant trends occurring in the UK when dealing with ESI and the party's obligations with ESI?
There are, I suppose, four strands, really. One is a run of cases that we had a couple of years ago now, which emphasized that the rules are not optional. The former practice direction that dated from 2005 was largely ignored by parties and by judges, and we'll come on to its successor in a minute. But we had a few cases, one called Earls against Barclays Bank, another one called Al Swedi against the Ministry of Defence, stand out in particular, as examples of cases where the problems were to do with simply not addressing the issue. They weren't technical failures. They were failure to use the rules, failure to understand some basic principles, really. And parties got caned for it in a manner that hurt their reputations as well as anything else. The second strand we'll come on to again in a minute. It's a case of Master Whitaker's called Goodale against the Ministry of Justice, which emphasized very much that cooperation can result in a very much reduced disclosure if the judge manages things and if parties have the discussions that they're supposed to have, identify the key players and work outwards from them rather than seek to collect everything and work inwards from that. That, as I say, you may want to ask Stephen Whitaker about in a moment. The third limb that's been important has been the e-disclosure practice direction and its questionnaire. We'll expand on that too, but the significance of it, put briefly, is that it brings that aspect of the rules out into the open where it's been rather concealed. And perhaps with the questionnaire, gives people the incentive rather than merely the duty to assemble the information that they're going to need at an early stage. The questionnaire itself applies only in relatively few cases, but we're finding, anecdotally at least, that people are seeing its benefits in cases for which it's not formally required. The last strand, which is not strictly a litigation strand, but is promoting thought and understanding on this, is the regulatory side, not just increased financial regulation generally, but most recently the UK Bribery Act, which comes into force next on the 1st of July, which includes to which there is a defence of having adequate procedures, and there's the strong suggestion that the additional incentive on companies, which the Bribery Act will bring, to get their house in order for all sorts of purposes, including litigation, as well as compliance of one kind or another, that will boot it up the agenda a bit. So those I see as the main elements at the moment.
Master Whitaker, what tools and approaches are you developing to minimize the pain of preservation and collection of ESI? Chris mentioned the e-disclosure project, and maybe you want to expand on that.
Yes, I think you have to bear in mind that we start from a rather different position in respect to disclosure than you do in the States, whether it's in the federal rules or in state courts. We abandon the idea of having to do a production of documents which not only were relevant but would lead to the discovery of other documents back in 1999. And we went to a system which I believe was tried for a time in the federal system in the States some years ago, but which was abandoned, and that's the standard disclosure system, whereby the test is effectively one has to produce only documents which support one's own case or damage one's case or support one's opponent's case. So we start from a rather different point of view, and I think that, and we also, of course, don't have quite the problem with sanctions. Chris has mentioned some cases which we've had in which there have been problems with disclosure, in which there's been embarrassment on all sides and sometimes extra expense, but we don't have the sort of court-led fines and sanctions system that tends to obtain very often in the federal courts and the states. So starting from that point of view, our tendency is not to expect people to collect everything and then start deciding what comes within the relevant disclosure test. And I think that allows for two things. One is what I'll call the staged approach in a moment, which is something which emphasis is given to in our practice direction. But I think the first thing is that we adopted, as far back as 2005, the idea that there should be prior discussion, i.e. prior to the search being carried out by the parties, of the extent and scope of that search and the sort of tools that are going to be used and the type of documents and the custodians, etc. In other words, we don't expect people to go and do the search and then talk about it. We expect them to talk about the search and to try to come to some sort of agreement of the extent of a reasonable search. Because in our system, that's what the problem over electronic disclosure is. It's what is the extent of a reasonable proportionate search for documents, given the fact that in the current situation we have with electronic documents, there are just going to be so many that very often it's totally disproportionate to try and collect everything, and indeed to even start reviewing it on the basis that you're going to look at everything that you collect. So that's the start. And the next thing is the staged approach. I think there's a great emphasis on the new practice direction came in last year. It was drafted by my subcommittee at the same time as the questionnaire. And the sort of things we're talking about are, as I say, pre-search meetings, discussion at those meetings of the categories of documents that are going to be searched for, discussion of what the scope of a reasonable search should be, limiting the disclosure of documents to certain categories of documents, to particular date ranges, custodians or types of documents, the use of the staged approach. We have two mentions of that in the practice direction. I think perhaps the most important one is under the heading reasonable search, where we say that in some cases the staged approach may be appropriate, with disclosure initially being given of limited categories of documents. Those categories may subsequently be extended for or limited, depending on the results initially obtained. So we put a lot more emphasis on looking at who the key custodians are, what the types of documents are that are most likely to be relevant. And by, for example, key custodians, I don't mean, all right, we look at everybody who could possibly have been involved. We really are looking for emphasis on the word key and starting with a search in respect of their documents and the particular types of documents, and moving forward in an incremental way, so that if that produces the documentation that is most likely to be the documentation relevant under the standard disclosure test, then we're not keen on moving further on than that. So on the back of that, we also are concerned about starting with documentation that's reasonably accessible. In other words, not going immediately to everything you can get from legacy systems or whatever else. Paragraph 24 of the direction says its primary source of disclosure of the SI is normally reasonably accessible data. And that people who want to go immediately, the first stage is to not reasonably accessible data, must demonstrate and the relevance and materiality of it justify the cost and burden of retrieving and producing it. I think it's a very different world from the Rule 34 type request situation that you have in the federal rules in the states. And the questionnaire really pigs on to the back of that. And I think Chris has already actually told us really what the point is. It's a method of making sure that both sides, or whatever number of parties we're involved with, are singing from the same hymn sheet when it comes to the discussions that they're going to have before making the search. It gives them a methodical way of getting all the information that's necessary from my clients about the types of documents, the custodians, the architecture of their systems, or how they're going to do the search, what techniques they're going to use, what software they're going to use, and everybody to concentrate on talking about all of those things and having the information ready to exchange. So that's really, Carl, the way it's going. Those are the tools we're now trying to use, and we're trying to narrow the scope of the initial search, because obviously the less documents you have to collect in the first place, the less you're going to have to then try and hone down in the usual way with deduplication, et cetera, et cetera, and the less you're going to have to submit to human review, which sadly is the most expensive part of the exercise.
You know, something strikes me from listening to this. Even though the goal of what you're trying to collect and produce is different between the two systems, it seems like a lot of what you're trying to do would fit very well within a structured meet and confer process in the United States. A lot of those components of the electronic documents questionnaire seem like the types of things that parties should be discussing over here. Chris,
yeah.
I know you talk quite a bit
Before you come to Chris, Carl, I should say we have to admit that we lifted the idea effectively of meet and confer from the U.S. system, even though we did it originally in 2005 when your new federal rules were still in draft, and I think came into effect in, December 2006, we definitely got the idea from the United States. So you're absolutely right. It does fit within that, and we're trying to push that, but on the basis of a very much narrower approach to the documentation that one should search for.
I'm just trying to return the favor here. I mean, we're going to, if there's something useful here, we'll lift it and bring it over back.
Yeah.
We may not
I think
be
it's,
as
it's
time.
Worth... It's worth drawing attention to the fact that, or re-emphasizing something that Master Whitaker has already said, we don't have the fear of sanctions hanging over our heads in the same way. You can be penalized for causing loss to the other side through some breach of the rules or some matter of conduct, but there isn't the awful thought that you're going to be struck out or suffer an adverse inference or a heavy financial penalty because of some defect, perhaps a technical defect along the way. That colours the whole approach to deciding what the scope is going to be. The sanctions, not everybody in the US agrees with me on this, but as I see it, sanctions drive discovery upwards and outwards because of you can't be wrong to overdo it is the general fear. And I think we're blessed in not having that particular climate. I think I'd like to just supplement what Stephen Whitaker has just said with two things. One, a point I made at Georgetown when much of the same discussion came up last November. We can describe our system and say, we do this, we do this, and we do that. It would be fair to say there are relatively few judges who have the same grasp of the implications that Master Whitaker and Judge Simon Brown and a few others do. I'm not saying there are none, but there are relatively few. And it would not be right, I think, to say that what obtains in their courts is the norm. It would also be fair to say that we're not going to see significant training for judges in this respect, even before the latest round of cuts. That, as I see it, throws a burden very heavily on the parties to understand that it is in their interest, the lawyers' interests and their clients' interests, to work for themselves, to narrow the ambit of disclosure. One can make the same creative use of the court's discretion as Stephen Whitaker did in the Goodale case, which he'll perhaps tell us more about in a moment, to effectively approach it by saying, what do we really need here? What's the problem we're trying to solve? Who are the people who matter? And what's the minimum work that can be done on all sides, transparently and openly, to ensure that justice is done with the judge acting in part as ringmaster. One of the things that one perhaps easily overlooks is that judges have spent their lives as barristers picking up new ideas from scratch very quickly and becoming expert in them. and one can make much better use than parties do, I think, of that facility by going along prepared to tell the judge more than the judge can reasonably be expected to know for himself, not least about the advances of technology. It's hard enough for those of us who are immersed in it to keep up to date with the advances in software and general ideas. And parties could be better than they are, lawyers could be better than they have been at shaping disclosure as they want it by invoking judicial discretion, with the Goodale case being, as I described it in one of my articles about it, a template for effective case management.
You know, you started off with something that I was going to talk about at the end, but I think it's a good enough time to mention it now. I was curious about your reaction, Chris, and also Master Whitaker, to the attempts which have come out of the Duke conference to amend the federal rules and perhaps create a uniform definition on spoliation and more instruction on preservation obligations. I know Judge Grimm's been involved with this, as Tom Allman and Dan Willoughby from King and Spalding wrote a really good article that we did a podcast on the growing trend of spoliation cases. I mean, based on your experience, not having that same threat and maybe having better defined rules, have you been pleased sort of with how that impacts the process? Is that a good thing?
It's a good thing in my view that we do not have the strictness that you have, that we rely much more on discretion, on what seems right, within certain obvious rules, and we have exactly the same principle that once litigation is in contemplation, you don't destroy documents, for example. That's one here's criticized on both sides of the Atlantic for being imprecise, but I can't for the life of me see how one could become more precise without excluding certain circumstances or without writing pages on how you define it. That definition, so far as I'm concerned, with its shades on both sides of the Atlantic, is just fine. Interestingly, we're getting the same debate going on about our Bribery Act at the moment, which has got a lot of slack in it in the sense that there's a lot of room left for discretion and for the judge at the end of the day. The US reaction on the whole is, how can one possibly be prepared for something like that because it's so imprecise, where the UK reaction is to be relatively relaxed and to think that it is better to have that scope for feeling what is right and judging what the court is likely to think is right, as opposed to, in a Bribery Act context, trying to put a pound or dollar sign beside every bit of entertainment, for example. So I see a cultural difference there. This need for precision in the US is something that we don't have as part of our legislative tradition here. It's worth adding that we have had a case in the last year which rubs people's noses in the fact that there's spoliation and there's spoliation. A case called Ryback and Langbar. A fellow was caught red-handed, effectively, applying deletion software across his computer, which was already the subject of an order for delivery up for imaging. I think the principles would have been the same even if it hadn't been subject to an order. His case was struck out, wholly clear that the litigation was in progress, even without the order. Not clear what files or what, if any, files were destroyed, but the judge felt entitled, and he's absolutely right, to say people who go around deleting files or giving the strong impression that they did don't deserve the attentions of the court. That's fine. That's all we need, I think, in terms of precision.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to add briefly, the position here is also very different because we have cost shifting as the norm. And so the risks on costs are quite great, and they're well known anyway. If any sort of mucking about, if I can put it that way, with that disclosure takes place, because it leads to more hearings, adverse costs orders on hearings, and consequently an increase in the overall cost of the litigation and the risk that's taken at the end of the day. I think, though, that we just don't have the same attitude. Chris has brought up the Ryback case, which is a good example of real spoliation. In this jurisdiction, the advocates tend to be cards up on the table anyway, tend to be more cooperative. That sort of case will generally speaking, be found out. The rest of it is more likely to be not so much deliberate spoliation as just a failure to appreciate where you should go and what you should do and how far you should take the search. And that's why our structure really concentrates on that. Very interesting to note that when we'd done the questionnaire and we sent it off for various people to look at, including Sedona, they said, oh, we did a questionnaire some time ago, but it never got anywhere. It's called the Jumpstart questionnaire, and they very kindly sent us a copy. And of course, when I read it, you can, as you might guess from what I've just said, what it really concentrated on more than anything else was the early stage of just trying to make damn sure that parties never got into a spoliation-type sanction situation. Not really what we're looking at, which is the guidance as to the whole structure of how you do the exercise.
The chief significance of Ryback, I think, because it says nothing new, the Ryback and Langbar case, is a reminder to parties on both sides, the lawyers and the parties on both sides, that those tempted to spoliate and those who are against them, that there are means of finding you out. Craig Ball has written a super article this week tracing exactly how he worked his way through a computer to establish that software had been cleaning software had been applied to a computer, and it's very salutary for lawyers to know that that can be done, so that they can firstly warn their own clients against the risk of being found out if they do it, and secondly be alert to the possibility that opponents might have done it, and to know that there are ways of catching them. All we have to make sure is that that itself doesn't lead to a culture of challenging every disclosure on the basis of presumed spoliation. That I see as a US trail that we do not wish to go down.
So let's. I wanted to talk a little bit, Chris, about the tools and approaches that you're developing or seeing being developed to facilitate creative search for ESI. This is something I'm very passionate about personally, and this also is probably a good time for Master Whitaker to follow that up with a talk a little bit about the Goodell case.
If by tools you mean applications, there are very few UK-based applications, except, of course, that Autonomy is equally a UK company and a US one. Most of the applications we have here for discovery, for disclosure, emanate either from the US or from Australia. And we're happy with that. If you take everything that we've said so far about the relative strictness, excessive strictness in some people's view, under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, software that's good enough for that, on the whole, is good enough for us. And so if by tools you meant those sort of applications, there are relatively few being developed over here. If by tools and approaches you meant how do we tackle the problem, well, I think we've already covered that. My very strong view is the one I've already articulated, that the lawyers need to see that it's in their interests and their clients' interests, certainly in their clients' interests, perhaps many of them would disagree that it's in their interests, certainly in their clients' interests, to bring down the scope of disclosure by developing a new way of using the rules. We have there is a tendency to plod through Part 31 from top to bottom in a fairly literal manner. And there are a set of new skills to be learnt, which include demonstrating that you're trying to be proportionate without looking evasive. It's quite a fine line, really, to be able to persuade your opponents in the court that you genuinely are trying to keep the cost down for good reason and for reasons that improve the litigation, when the temptation is to assume that you're trying to conceal something. And that there's an art in explaining things.
So let's talk then a little bit about the Goodell case, Master Whitaker, which you'd authored. What was at stake, and how did it get resolved?
Yes, it was a case brought against the government department in respect to the treatment of prisoners in the prison service, those that had gone into prison needing treatment for substance abuse. I think the important point about the case, more than anything else, though, is that it was one of those cases, as very often these cases against the government are, in which the burden of disclosure was very much on one side. In other words, all the relevant documents basically were with the government and not with the claimants, for obvious reasons. And my experience of those cases is they're the ones where you most need a staged approach. You most need control of the search and the disclosure process, because, not surprisingly, the tendency of the party that doesn't have the massive burden of disclosure is to push for more and more and more. So we do tend to get a little bit nearer, perhaps, the situation that sometimes exists in US litigation. The important point about it is that the government department in question had huge amounts of electronically stored information, and it was spread over various people, various sites, various media, etc., etc. The usual nightmare situation, which would have led, using the old-fashioned idea of collect everything and then produce everything and then review everything, totally unacceptably expensive and far beyond the value of the claim. I think the claimants looked at it slightly differently on the basis, of course, that there were human rights issues involved in relation to the treatment of prisoners. So they saw that as quite a strong factor on the other side of the scale. But basically, what I was concerned to do was to make sure that a staged approach was taken to the disclosure in question, and that we started by looking at the really key custodians and looking at only certain types of documentation, including one particular structured database. And we started there to see whether everything that the claimants actually were needed to pursue the case, that there was effectively a decision that for systemic reasons the prisoners would be treated in a certain way generally rather than on an individual basis. The other thing that came out of it, I think, was quite important, was that the volume of the documentation was so great that I felt that I was bound to suggest to them that they should look at rather more subtle ways of finding, once they'd searched, the documents that were really needed to be produced, than just simple keyword searching. And I'd just been demonstrated one of the first predictive coding packages at the time, only a few months before, and was very impressed with it. And I actively encouraged them to consider that. The fact of the matter is, I think it's highly likely that the case will come to a negotiated settlement. Obviously, I shan't know what the reasons for that were, but it could well be related to the fact that the overwhelming burden of disclosure related to one party rather than the other, but at least I think I did my bit to try and reduce the scope of it considerably.
Well, that's actually a very good lead into the next question, Chris. I was going to ask you about any reaction to the front page New York Times article. I'm not sure if you saw it or heard about it. It was recently published about 3 weeks ago. It predicted inexpensive software is going to put armies of lawyers out of work. And its focus, although it wasn't clearly stated in the article because they mixed all sorts of technologies that weren't really what they were talking about, but it really was focusing on predictive coding, I believe. And do you have any reaction to that? Did that create any stir over on your side of the ocean?
I certainly did have a reaction and spent the ensuing weekend writing a long article about it. It's an important article, and that doesn't mean I agree with it, as you'll see if you read my article. But I agree with it to the extent that the software is coming. The software is improving, particularly the predictive coding of solutions of one kind or another. And they are fulfilling a lot of the functions more cheaply and more effectively than roomfuls of lawyers. The key point about that article, is the fact that it was on the front page, that it was there to be read by CEOs and financial directors and others who would not necessarily go to read a litigation paper or a paper about the science of search. It was there as being pushed into the mainstream. You don't find articles in that with that degree of prominence in a newspaper like that when one's at the early adoption stage. So it becomes a sort of this mere publication becomes a sort of marker that we're moving from early adoption into a wider sphere. There will have been a lot of telephone calls the following day, I think, to lawyers on the Monday anyway, two lawyers saying, "What are you doing about this?" The fact that I agree as to the spread of the technology does not mean that I agree, as I did not in my article, that this means that the death of lawyers. The line that I took, which was paralleled by one which Ralph Lucy was taking, writing at the same time as I was that there is a need for and room for new skills on behalf of lawyers. And things like project management, the ability to understand the role and the place of technology, and all those things are new skills. They're not innate. They're not something they're trained to. And those who are going to come through this out on top need to understand that, need to understand how these things work. There will be casualties, undoubtedly, but I don't see a decimation of the population of lawyers, although it has to be said that with 45,000 new lawyers being pushed out into the US system every year, many of them with no jobs to go to. That is itself a reason why there are going to be lawyers out of work. Nothing to do with how systems are taking work away from lawyers. There's simply too many of them anyway, and the same is true over here. There will also be an effect that John Markoff didn't take account of, I think, which is that as this stuff gets cheaper, so it will be used for a wider range of cases. There will be more document-heavy litigation pushing into the arena where the technology is useful. That, in turn, I think, will bring down the price of the technology. And we'll see a different economic model. In my article, I equated it to the Luddites of the early 19th century smashing up machines where they could. There's a sort of economic fallacy there which suggests that that's the end of the world. It isn't. The world changes. Different emphasis is put on different things. People have more disposable income in some ways, not necessarily now, not necessarily at this moment in the middle of a recession, not to, wherever we are in the recession. But the model changes. And I think the technology is a force for good for those who are willing to grab it and use it.
And actually, Master Whitaker, you had mentioned you had seen a demonstration of some predictive coding technology. And the biggest question that lawyers have, in particular in response to the New York Times article, but even before it, was the defensibility of these tools. And although you're outside of the U.S. jurisdiction, you're still a legal scholar dealing with these types of issues who's obviously concerned about whether or not these things are effective and work. What reaction do you have as to sort of defensibility of using these types of techniques?
Yes, I think the fact is that on this subject, the position would have to be exactly the same here as it is in the States. I think one's got to be very careful, though, when talking about things like putting armies of lawyers out of work, not to frighten the horses, because let's face it, what we're trying to do here is get back into the sort of situation we were before all of the electronic material began to become the only way in which information was exchanged and stored, where the lawyers in any given case only have to review the absolute minimum number of documents. There's never going to be a situation in which machines will take over the entire function. Whether it might be possible to teach a computer how to distinguish a privileged document from a non-privileged document is a question which I've never had satisfactorily answered yet. But the fact is, there is always going to be review. What we need to do is to get the amount of this review down to the lowest possible level. And this is where defensibility comes in on our side of the Atlantic, and I'm sure it's very much the same in the States. When we were dealing entirely with paper documents, the general received wisdom of the courts and indeed of opponents in litigation was you couldn't do a truthful disclosure exercise and put your signature to a disclosure statement, for example, as we have here, saying that you've done what you're supposed to do as a matter of law, unless you read every page. You couldn't go into court and say to a judge, when there was a warehouse full of documents, oh, well, we only read three quarters of them because it was only proportionate to read three quarters, so we left the rest of them unread. That would have been an impossible approach. But the fact of the matter is now, with the proliferation of electronically stored information and documentation, there has to be a proportionate approach, and there has to be some way of cutting down the amount of material that humans have to read. And that means that the further we move forward in this endeavor, the less documents humans are going to read and the more machines are going to read. And the important point is that machines are there to try and make sure that the humans read the ones that are important. Now, we've all seen the use of keyword searching to try and find the ones that are important. I personally regard keyword searching as a very dangerous tool, which can sometimes produce totally unforeseen consequences. I'm much more attracted to the type of software which ranks documentation for relevance, so that at least the parties then have a choice as to how far they go down the line in reading documentation individually. And then how much after that they simply sample it. So defensibility means in two things. It means you've got to be able to go before a court and satisfy the court that the approach you're taking, which means that not every document will be read, even if it's just because it's getting rid of duplicates, is acceptable. And you've got to be able to convince your opponents as well that the methods you're going to use are acceptable. And that's where predictive coding software becomes a little bit more problematical, because there's still a lot of ignorance about how it works and what it does. I'll give you an example. I did a seminar at KPMG in the City of London only a few weeks ago, in which someone said to me, well, my worry about predictive coding software is that when we've run it all, we're going to be handing over a lot of documents that we've not looked at, which might be privileged. Which immediately led me to think that the person asking the question just did not understand, of course, that you'd only ever be handing over documents you had looked at. The purpose of the software is just to reduce down the number of documents so that you do have to review, and it's only those documents when you've reviewed them, and probably even less than all of them, that you're going to hand over. So defensibility between the parties, in other words, is your opponent satisfied that the use of that software in the way you're going to use it is proportionate and is going to produce a reasonable search. The other thing that worries me, and I've raised this, I think I raised it on a panel in New York, the thing that strikes me about predictive coding software is the one way that it could be, perhaps its defensibility might be challenged, is on the basis that the opposing party has had no input into the way the software was trained in order to rank the documents according to their relevance. And I think this is a problem that we're going to have to face over here. And I think if we do, I certainly got provisional views as to how both parties could become involved in the training exercise, certainly in such a way that the other party doesn't get to see privileged material, at least during the training exercise. But at least is involved in such a way that it gives authority to the training exercise and therefore stamps authority on the results and the extent to which the results are searched. So those are the sort of issues I think we've got coming. I certainly know in one case, I can't name it, but I've certainly been told about a case in the Chancery Division in which both parties put forward to the judge the idea of using predictive coding software, explained to him how it worked, and it was, the court accepted it as perfectly sensible and a proportionate approach to that particular case, and no doubt it was a highly successful exercise. That's the sort of thing we need to be aiming at, not long arguments about keywords, the production of absurdly long lists of keywords. I had a case only recently in which one of the keywords was road. Not exactly the most sensible thing to have when you're searching documentation, particularly anything that's ever addressed to other people. So I want to move away from that. I want to see us move away from that. I want us to see us get technology to try and solve the problems that technology's created.
I think the answer that Stephen's just given, the example rather, that he's just given of parties going before a court and having agreed, amplifies what I said earlier about the lawyers acquiring the skills to understand it themselves sufficiently to explain it to others, so including the judge. One of the overlooked elements in much of the predictive coding software that's out there is the transparency of it, the ability to invite sampling either side of whatever boundary that you've set, to say to the other side, well, this is the stuff that's just below where we decided the cutoff was, for example. Come and have a look. Do you really want that? Can you really argue that it's proportionate, that we should all have to wade through that lot? So that might be, yes, there is the privilege point that Stephen Whittaker raised, and that has to be got round by some means or another. But that is an extension, effectively, of the cooperative notions that we talked about at the beginning, which the practice direction doesn't merely sanction, it requires. A further observation, I think, is that even in paper warehouse days, we used to make fairly rough and ready selections about, and perfectly properly, where a box appeared from a quick skim to have nothing whatever that was going to be helpful, to decide as much and to leave it out. So we're not talking about wholly new concepts by saying that certain categories of documents are not to be disclosed.
One thing that sort of comes to mind, when I've done a few shows on this, is the concept that we are going to make mistakes with these newer technologies, but we make so many mistakes with what we're doing right now. I mean, just a huge number of mistakes. The keyword example that Master Worker gave is great and frequently happens. So I agree with that completely. The other thing is, and this is the one of the points I've reacted when I saw the New York Times article, is it just emphasizes how much more important the people are, because machines aren't going to pick, the humans are, and the humans are the ones that are going to set the classifiers. And it's really, I think it's a fascinating time in e-discovery that we're actually looking at these tools and trying to figure out how to use them now. At least I hope we are. Some days I feel like we are, and some days I feel like the barriers are put up and it'll be a harder thing to push forward.
We're making progress, Carl. Brace up.
The last question I like to ask is just because I always find it interesting to ask judges who have a unique perspective, and you may have already answered it, but just to make sure, where do you see your biggest challenges in e-discovery from sitting on the bench? Is it the education that you were talking about before? I won't put answer in your head. Whatever you're seeing.
I think it's quite fair to disclose that you've at least suggested some to me, and I've thought about them. I think undoubtedly, from my point of view, the important thing is to educate the lawyers on how to handle ESI. I think we're still, if not in the dark ages in the profession, we've probably only reached the middle ages at the moment. There are some, the big firms, some smaller firms are very hot on this and know all about it. but I'm afraid there's a huge amount of ignorance, and even among those who do know something about it, the sort of standard of appreciation of the technologies, etc., really extends no further than keywords. They tend to think that keywords are the answer in every case, and that's one of the reasons why when we wrote the practice direction, we did put something in it to try and draw people's attention to the fact that that's not always a very satisfactory way of dealing with it. So I think that comes highest on the list. Dealing with tremendous volumes of ESI being one of the biggest challenges, well, I think that's a given. The fact is that the time will come, and it's not that far off, where virtually every case will involve nothing but electronically stored information, and we simply have to cope with it. And I think we are a bit ahead of the curve here. We have got this practice direction. We have got this questionnaire. It's there already before the really big numbers of cases involving purely ESI have really started to come along. Educating solicitors to cooperate more is one of the things you suggested. I think the CPR, the civil procedure rules that came in back in 1999, have done a lot of that job for us already. The culture here is to cooperate. The idea is to have cards face upwards on the table in litigation, to try to settle litigation without going to court, and if you have to go to court, to settle it as easy as possible on a fully informed basis. And part of the fully informed basis, of course, involves the concept of disclosure, but disclosure being made in a proportionate way so that the costs don't, at that stage, completely outweigh the whole value of the claim and negate the purpose of the exercise. So I think educating solicitors to cooperate more is something that's not so much the point. The point is educating the solicitors, educating the profession, and educating judges. Chris has already touched on this point in terms of the judiciary. I think we are a long way behind with this. A very large number of the judiciary are aware that there's a problem here, but are not really aware very much of what the problems are. I think the trouble with our system in this country, Carl, to be honest, is that the disclosure exercise has always been one traditionally that the courts have left entirely for the parties to deal with. Even when the court in the civil procedure rules in 1999 took over the management of cases from the parties, they still left the management of disclosure very firmly in the lawyers' courts, in their hands rather, because frankly, it's not something a lot of judges want to get too involved in. One of the things we hate most of all are applications for what we call specific disclosure. In other words, when the first general disclosure exercise has been done, to then have one party saying, well, there are all these other categories of documents we want to see, because it's a long and very tedious exercise to go through all these various categories and make a ruling on them. It's probably one of the most boring functions in the interlocutory process of litigation that you possibly imagine. So there's a bit of a reluctance to get in there and get roll your sleeves up. But I think that's all the more reason why the judiciary need to learn the broad techniques and to learn about the sort of things that are available. Because really all that's needed is not so much getting right into the middle of it and rolling your sleeves up, it's having the knowledge to be able to guide people when they've got all their information to exchange, when they've discussed the situation and discussed the search, to give them the guidance that they need or to make the decisions they need in order to try and make the search reasonable and proportionate. And more than anything else, I think if I had to finish on any note at all, it would be to have an understanding of the fact that in the modern electronic age, you can't have justice to the nth degree. So we're not looking to assist the parties to search ad nauseam for the smoking gun. We're contemplating the fact that the smoking gun, if it's there, might never be found, because what we're looking at is something that, as I say, is a reasonable and proportionate search. And that's very much what the broad approach, I think, that the judiciary need to be trained to follow.
So to pursue the history theme that we started with, we've had the Dark Ages and we're in the Middle Ages. We hope to be heading for the Age of Enlightenment.
It's always dangerous to throw out historical terms to Americans. What are the Middle Ages?
That's, it might be
the 50s, right?
Might be the Reformation as well.
Yeah. The Industrial Revolution. Don't worry about it, Carl.
No, I have thoroughly enjoyed this discussion. I want to thank both Master Whitaker and Chris Dale for joining us here at ESI Bytes. This is, I think, always interesting to look outside of our borders and try to figure out how others are dealing with this, because there are often better, good ideas that you don't think about in your own system. So thank you for taking the time. Hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. It sounds out phonetically as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shineman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, wishing you a nice day.